Welcome to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and if I sound a bit nasal today, I do apologise. I've caught the perpetual October flu, so yes, do excuse me. You might have noticed that a lot of conversations about Brexit are dominated by events in Westminster. And today we've once again chosen to go against that grain. Tim and Warren talked to Northern Irish businessman and endurance athlete Conor Devine to get some rare insight into the minds of Irish people, Northern and Southern alike. They chatted to Conor about the precious few opportunities that can still be found and about how a hard border could throw a precarious and decades-long peace process on the island into disarray. If you enjoy the show, you can rate us on your podcast platform of choice. And while you're there, you might as well subscribe so you can get all upcoming episodes sent straight to your phone. To leave us suggestions for future guests or just say hi, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Brexit Podcast.
Conor Devine, welcome to the Brexit Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to having a chat with you about this.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Conor, you came recommended by my co-host Warren Pohl. You're both big fans of endurance sport, so as a special treat, I've got Warren alongside me today.
Hey, Conor, how's it going?
Excellent. Warren, good to hear your voice.
It's good. Good to hear from you.
So maybe we'll get on to some of the endurance stuff later, but first let's go straight in on the topic of Brexit. Northern Ireland voted 56% to remain, but you're out like the rest of us, so we don't hear masses in the London-centric media over here. So what's the general mood like over there at the moment?
Well, it's really, really interesting over here. It's a huge topic of discussion. I suppose on the polls, I think, I'm not sure what the overall turnout was for here. Maybe you have that stat. I'm not sure what 60% over here or 70%. I don't know what it was.
It's pretty high across the board, I think.
Yeah, well, so you have 50, the majority of people who voted wanted to remain, and then you had a fair number of folk who wanted to exit, but we're all tied in with the UK. So, I mean, I'm working in Belfast City Centre. I'm a chartered surveyor. I've been in business here for 15 years. I'm working with the institutions, the banks and the business community for a long time. And, I mean, it's just people just don't really know what it means. So there's probably a lot of what the rest of the UK is thinking, we're thinking over here as well. So in that regard, there's probably no particular difference. I mean, the Conservatives, the Tories don't know what it means. Let's be honest, nobody really knows what Brexit means. A little bit of toing and froing. You hear the word coming out of Brussels and Juncker and a lot of these people that, you know, that they have to be firm and protect the other 27 odd countries. And I think it's going to get really messy, to be honest with you. I don't see any sort of soft landing in this one. I just can't see that happening. The big difference over in Ireland, of course, is that we border the Republic of Ireland. They're our biggest trading partner. And the interesting triangle is that the UK is the biggest trading partner of the Republic of Ireland. I think it's a little bit more complicated over here, guys, because as you guys are very, very aware that we are coming out of pretty much a period, 30-odd years of the Troubles, stroke a pretty much a war, which was quite nasty, and there was over 4,000 people lost their lives in this part of the world. And over the last 20 years, thankfully, we're in peaceful times, and there was a Good Friday Agreement that was struck in 1998. And I think the challenge that Theresa May has now is that there's a constitutional question has been brought into the dispute here now, because Europe played a key role, and I'm not a political person, but I am interested in politics, but Europe has played a real positive role in Ireland in terms of, you know, support, and more so financial support. I mean, there's been hundreds of millions of euro being poured into the Republic of Ireland and into the north of Ireland. We call it peace money.
Yeah.
And that has facilitated and helped our infrastructure. And I mean, if you go down to the Republic of Ireland now, Warren, I know you're over here recently. I don't think you got a chance to take a spin down. But, I mean, the infrastructure, I remember going flying out of Dublin Airport 20 years ago. And, I mean, you were driving through old towns that hadn't been developed or improved. And now, I mean, we've got a terrific network of motorways throughout the main thoroughfares of Ireland. And a lot of that is down to the peace money. So there's a real problem in the north of Ireland at the minute because, for example, there's about £200 million of so-called peace money that was due to come into Northern Ireland from the European project, let's call it, over the next 4 years, right?
Yeah.
And I know that our finance minister has asked for reassurances from David Davies and Theresa May in the Treasury. And, I mean, we still don't know what's happening there. I think we're getting a bit of a blank wall, and that's causing a lot of concern because this money, although a lot of it's for infrastructural works, it's also for social and economic projects within, right down to the heart of communities, you know, to develop communities that are struggling through poverty and all sorts of stuff. So it's a real issue in that regard, and the border issue is a massive issue for this part of the world.
Yeah.
Pretty much, and this is where it starts to get complicated and where it totally differentiates itself from the likes of Scotland and England, because for the most part, the Scots and the English have been living together pretty peacefully. The difficulty over in this part of the world, as we all know, is, you know, half the population want to be British and the other half the population want to be Irish. Mm. And a fair number of the population have various passports. And it's a big question around the border. And this is something that, you know, nobody has an answer for. And I just think that the whole thing has been an absolute car crash, badly thought out, badly planned. And we can all, even if we looked at, you know, Andrew Marr on Sunday, where Boris had penned his letter to remain, and then he came out with his explanation for that, where he penned another letter to exit, and then he thought which was best. And it's a very peculiar way to come to decision, but he is a peculiar man. But on the border issue here, guys, the problem is, if you have 50 painters flying in from Poland to Dublin, because Dublin, in terms of its real estate market, there's a lot of stuff happening there. And if you have 50 painters flying in from, say, Warsaw, and they start painting all these schemes, and then they get a job in Belfast, and they get into 10 highest vans, and they travel up from Europe, okay?
Yep.
Mm. And they come to Newry, and the only way you're going to be able to stop these guys is that there's some form of customs or hard border. And the difficulty around that is that potentially throws the whole peace process into disarray. And I'm not being inflammatory there. The situation here is very, very shaky in that, as part of the peace agreement that was reached here between both sides, and the Irish government had a role to play, the British government and Europe, the border disappeared.
Yeah. Right?
And that was to satisfy probably people on the more nationalist side who see themselves as Irish, and it was part of the peace deal, end of story. So the challenge, I mean, Northern Ireland throws a number of challenges into the pot for Westminster, and I just think, I mean, me personally, I'm not sure what we contribute to Westminster in general. I mean, we're technically insolvent chaps, and I'm not running ourselves down, but we're very good people over here and we're brilliant at lots of things. But Westminster, the Treasury writes this place a cheque for £10 billion every year, right?
And that's in addition to the EU money as well, is it, Connor?
Yeah, so it costs the Treasury, it costs Whitehall £10 billion to run this place. Right?
By which you mean Northern Ireland?
Correct.
Yeah.
So we don't send you £10 billion. You send us £10 billion, with me.
Yeah.
So the business model, if you want to look at this as a business, the economic argument to keep Northern Ireland, it's hard to stack, right?
Yeah.
Look at the cold figures, right? And then you throw into the mix, because it's always, the peace process has been an imperfect peace. I mean, it's been fantastic as a young person growing up here who wants to be positive and we're really strong over here. I mean, the Irish people growing up in this part of the world, I think it was ingrained in this, we're really driven to keep going.
It sounds like you think the European Union was a strong binding force with that as well.
I'm not saying that, because I personally think the European project is flawed. I don't see how it can survive, is my personal views long term. I think it's bust. I think the model is unfair. I think the best thing to do was probably what Cameron was trying to do poorly, which was to try and change it from within. I just don't see how you can run a monetary policy, economic policy that suits Germany, and the same policy suits the leg of Greece. It's it's comparing apples with apples and it's clearing up the case. But that's sort of a different thing. I think the challenge and the discussion, the big discussion point around Brexit in Northern Ireland today is, number one, around what's going to happen financially. We need all the money we can get over here. We've been underinvested for 50 years. And then number two, what's going to happen with the border? And then whatever does happen with the border, is that going to impact on the peace? Because there's a lot of Republican people from a Republican mindset, from a nationalist mindset, who would love to see maybe a border come up again, present itself again.
And just to be clear there, Connor, when you say border, I mean, clearly there's a geographical border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but you're talking about a hard border as in, you know, checkpoints, passports, whatever. At the moment, people can freely travel across. Is that what you're saying, just to make it clear?
Yeah, so I suppose for clarity, so if we were to jump in the car today from my house, which is close to Belfast, and drive to the Republic of Ireland, we would drive to the last town in Northern Ireland, which is Newry, and over the next 6 miles, you would cross this imaginary border. But it used to be, when I say a hard border, it was a hard border. I mean, the British Army had a huge presence there. There was a lot of British Army, unfortunately, lost their lives around the border. It has been a real problem area. It's South Armagh. Google South Armagh. It's been a real problem for the British government to control. And that was a real hard, hard, difficult situation at that time. Along came the peace process. And obviously, Europe backed the peace process politically and financially. So, and then it's written into, and I haven't seen this, but it's written into some sort of European, some form of European legislation that, you know, in terms of the constitutional question and stuff, I'm not versed on it yet, I can't articulate it properly, but the return of some form of customs, even, you know, the British Army or the police force on the border would be a really bad development here. Nobody wants it here, right?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
The challenge, and on the radio today, one of the suggestions that was brought up by one of the politicians, I mean, it's on the TV tonight, there's a debate on in television locally here tonight at 10 o'clock about a lot of these issues, was that the border has to be at Britain, and that Ireland people can move about easily, and I just don't see how that works. You know, you can't be half pregnant.
So I mean, there's an incredible amount to chew through there, and looking at the way, you know, one domino could topple the next in another direction, and on they go. But just to pick one place to start, I'd like to look at the funding element. If you've got the EU funding element, so the EU money comes in to Northern Ireland. The peace money comes to Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. Is that money that, I mean, because clearly some of that would be taxpayers' money from Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland, but are you saying that it is a net gain for Ireland, as in whatever Ireland puts into the taxpayers' pot that then goes to the EU funding is received back in multiples that are greater than the amount put in? Is it like that?
You see, we I don't know, I don't have the figures as such, but I would imagine Northern Ireland's contribution to any UK money that's been put into the European project is minimal, right? So I think it's been a clear win, home run for us, any European money that's come in here in terms of net gain. Right, because we're probably benefiting off the UK's contribution, and then I know there was over and above monies put in as part of the peace money deal, if that makes sense.
So both economic and social benefits that you described.
Absolutely, I mean Europe has been a key player here in all of Ireland in terms of, you know, investment and regional development and infrastructure, and I mean that was one of the main issues here. You know, whenever people, I know from an agricultural point of view. One of the issues that the farmers has is the farmers, I suppose, all over the UK are struggling at the minute to make money and the price of dairy and milk and everything else. But, I mean, there's this big question, what's going to replace the fee farm grant? You know, and the problem with all of this is clearly, before the referendum should never have happened at that time because nobody was prepared and nobody had articulated the argument to stay or to leave properly. And the issue clearly is that Cameron winged this whole thing. It's totally obvious. And he took it for granted that I mean, even the media, even the bookmakers got this wrong. So they all assumed that that they were going to remain, and they took their eye off the ball, which was completely reckless, right? Mm-hmm. Totally reckless. And they've been caught out, and he obviously paid for it by the sword, resigned within 24 hours, gone. And now we're all left to pick up the pieces and work this crap out.
If the EU referendum was held today, where the citizens of Northern Ireland perhaps know a little bit more, and particularly the border issue is now coming more to the fore, because as you start to question, what are you going to do? How do you think the vote would have gone?
Well, I think probably that would be... there would be more in favour of Remain, because people like me probably would have come out to vote. I have to be honest, guys, I didn't vote. Slightly ashamed, but I haven't voted in, I suppose, the last 5 or 6 years politically, and I'm very disillusioned with politics, although I'm really interested in it, and it's probably a lazy position to take. But, you know, I think more people like me who probably assumed that Remain was going to win it easy, which it sort of did over here.
Yes.
But I think a lot of people would have come out. I mean, a lot of people voted to leave the EU here as a protest vote. Thinking. I mean, I've spoken to business people who voted to leave and then said, fuck, I can't believe we actually won this vote. You know, this is unbelievable. But it was really a protest against the establishment, against the real issues which probably won the vote, which was immigration and this whole question around sovereignty. And so I think what you'll find in Northern Ireland, a lot of the people from the unionist denomination would have formed a lot of the leave vote, you know, and predominantly the 56% would have been Remain from nationalists.
In terms of migration, is it, how high is it up at the news agenda in Northern Ireland?
I mean, I just find this whole topic of migration and as nearly at this stage insulting. Like, you know, who are we, Irish people and English people and Scots people and Welsh people, to tell the world that you can't come into our country? Like, we have travelled the world for hundreds of years. You go anywhere, New York, Sydney, Beijing, I've been all around the world. And we're everywhere. Our pubs are everywhere. We're all over Spain. And all of a sudden, over the last 15 years, we take a bit of a notion and say, oh, there's too many foreigners here. We need to stop them coming in. I think it's nauseating. Yeah. I just think it's really sad, because I know I did okay academically, just okay. But I know the growth that I have achieved as a person was got through travel and meeting people and sharing experiences, new languages, new foods, all that sort of stuff. And I just think this whole argument around immigration is coming from people who unfortunately haven't had that opportunity to go travel, go see the world, go integrate with people and learn from other people. It really pisses me off, lads, that migration foreigner mindset is pretty sad.
You've also been involved with, just changing tack slightly, a lot of startups and helping out and advising with a lot of startups. I know you're a very successful businessman. How do you think those guys will prosper moving forward? And do you see a change perhaps in their mindset, in the entrepreneurial mindset, to work through problems and see opportunities?
I think in general, across the UK and certainly in Ireland at the minute, there's a real liquidity problem. So that just means there isn't a lot of money in the system. It means our banks have pulled in their horns, they've changed their lending principles. It's now harder to borrow money across the board. And that is going to have an impact on economic growth, on startups and on ideas. I mean, tomorrow we're launching a new business called ClearPath Finance, and I'm totally shameless about the plug. But that is to try and stimulate the Northern Ireland economy, where we have convinced some lenders in the UK, it's peer-to-peer business, to lend money to the SME community over here, because we have a real... post-Brexit, I mean, we already had a liquidity problem.
Yes, yeah.
So I think, in direct answer to your question, Brexit will make it more difficult for people who are startups and trying to, you know, get new capital and access to finance. There's no doubt about that. I spoke to one of the top guys in Bank of Ireland quite recently, off the record, and he felt that Brexit had put their bank back 2 years. If you think about it, they had a lot of sterling on their books, mm-hmm. and sterling dropped 20-odd percent I mean, it doesn't take a rocket science to work out that if you lose 20% of your cash reserves, it's probably not a good day at the office. So, you know, I think I personally think my own views on in terms of economy and money and finance and stuff, as I watched the, I don't know if you watched The Big Short yet, guys. Have you seen it?
I have, absolutely. Yep.
Good show.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
I mean, my approach to business now in the last 3 years is what everybody else is doing, have a look at it and then do the complete opposite. my view right now is that there's problems on the horizon here. Most people accept with Brexit that there's going to be, it might be better long term, 5, 7, 10 years for the UK to row their own boat, right? We will never know that, but it might be. And the reasons I'm saying that is because I believe this European model is potentially going to erupt. And the reason I'm saying that is because if you look at Italy, France, Portugal, Spain, and you look at the banking system, every one of their banks are broken. There's so much debt within the banking system of a lot of those. I mean, 2 weeks ago, Deutsche Bank had issues with their balance sheet, and there was talk that Deutsche Bank were going to need a bailout. That's one of the biggest banks in the world. The debt problem, which brought the crash in 2007, has not been addressed at all. And I know for sure that the Italian, Spanish, Portuguese banks are in the process of selling trillions of euros worth of loans at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened in Ireland, interestingly, around all this, because it's sort of all linked in, it's all to do with confidence, is that the Irish banks created this thing called NAMA in 2010 and basically dumped their loans to American private equity investors. So most of the real estate now in Ireland, North and South, is owned by the likes of Cerberus, Goldman Sachs, Carval, a lot of these big American private equity funds.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge that they all have here is how do they exit? Because they were hoping the banking system would be back to help local people buy their assets back. And I just think with the inflation news out today, where prices are going to increase, sterling's low, it's going to probably continue to drizzle and weaken maybe. I think that there's real headwinds ahead. I really do. I mean, the indicators are all pointing to a rough 3 or 4 or 5 years. And I mean, the Brexiteers have already said this, so I'm not really saying anything new.
So do you see another crash a la 2008 coming up? I know it's predicted in The Big Short.
Well, I personally do believe that if the world is a there's a proxy World War III going on at the moment in the Middle East. You have Russia and Syria fighting against the West, more or less. And you have Saudi Arabia and Yemen fighting with the West against Russia and Syria. And that's going on, and we all know what's going on. It is a proxy war. You have NatWest closing down RT. You've probably seen this yesterday, Warren.
Yeah.
Did you see where NatWest closed the Russian Today bank accounts in London?
Has that storm passed today? Did they reopen things today, or had I read that wrong?
So yesterday it broke, and was watching some Max Kaiser, which is good entertainment, and it broke that basically NatWest issued a statement to say, we're closing your accounts 12th of December, non-negotiable, goodbye. And then all of a sudden today, they redacted that, and apparently they're going to allow them to keep it open. So politically, something happened there. There's this sitcom going on in America at the minute, which really tells me where the world's at the minute, upside down, where you've got this guy Trump, which is fighting out an election with Clinton. And I'm in touch with business people in America at the moment, and I mean, I've got a good friend. I'm going to New York in 2 weeks' time. He's a career banker in New York. I would value this guy as a good friend, good judgment, smart. He's worked in Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, the whole McCoy, and he's a Republican. And I asked him, I've been asking him every few months, who are you voting for? And he wouldn't tell me, but he told me the other day, he says he's voting for Trump. And the reason why he's voting for Trump is because he can't bring it upon himself to vote for Hillary, because of her ties with the establishment and all the other stuff that's going on there. And I just find that incredible. So, I mean, the world, if you look at The Big Short, the world's upside down at the moment. There's something like 7 countries out of 70 or 80 that is at peace, and the rest of us have some form of political or some form of military war situation going on. So it's difficult times, guys.
Certainly is. I mean, to step it back to Brexit in that wider context, the financial car crash, you know, there's a lack of liquidity, but we've got basically zero interest rates and money being pumped in by all the federal banks and all the national banks. That should bring liquidity, but it's not there. Then you've got political instability as well that's throwing things out on top of that. Then you've got conflict. Then you've got border issues. In amongst all of this, is Brexit even a significant factor?
I think it's a massive factor, because what it does is it brings it breaks confidence, and it confidence in any market. I mean, what investors don't like is uncertainty, and I mean, we couldn't have a more uncertain time. I mean, this is historic. It's breaking a 50-year relationship. We haven't a clue how this thing's going to work out. We don't know what Article 50 means. I mean, these clampets haven't even provided a business plan for, and you know, remain or exit. I mean, the whole thing is a joke, guys. Like, I mean, Cameron has to take responsibility for this, because he's went into this one and called it wrong, big time. You know, there should have been a 2-year consultation on this vote. There should have been loads of debates. There should have been loads of opportunities for people to engage at a community level. And maybe we all would have voted to leave, and that's fine. But then we would have been able to make an educated decision. People were going into ballot boxes going, you know, I'm not sure. Like, you know, there's too many foreigners here. Right, okay, we'll exit. But nobody knows what that means. You know, it's totally preposterous what happened. Like, we must be the dumbest people in terms of a generation that's knocked about for the last 100 years.
Now,
it's incredible.
Now, your book, the title of your book is Attitude is Everything. So,
yeah.
So where you are now, and so you're sounding quite down on the current situation, how do you think it can be turned around? How do you think you can start turning it around?
Well, I think you have to. I'm giving you very macro views of the world and the economy and Brexit and locally and all the rest of it. But I think what I'm trying to do every morning is try and make a difference and try and be creative and try and get around positive people and try and come up with solutions. I mean, our business, GDP Partnership, we sell solutions. We sell people. And they just have to come in the form of financial solutions in terms of our new business, ClearPath, our debt mediation business. But I think all we can do as individuals is continuously embrace and immerse ourselves in personal development, continue to grow, try and add value to our offering all the time. I mean, Warren Buffett, I read Snowball about 10 years ago, big admiration for the likes of Warren Buffett, and he goes and gives a talk to the university students once a year, I think, and he gets this question, he says in the book every year, from the students, excuse me, Mr. Buffett, so obviously, as you know, through Berkshire Hathaway, he's got stakes and Heinz and Coca-Cola and all these companies, and the most common question he gets from the students is, excuse me, Mr. Buffett, what was your best investment? And the answer he gives all the time is, the best investment I've ever made is in myself, through personal development. So that I immersed myself in, once I got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis at 26 years of age, I was a director in a company, I was just married, I had a great life, I was very fortunate, I was playing Irish League football, I was very sporty, I was in great form, and then I got wiped out with this illness, which put me in a bad spot for about 4 or 5 years. And it was through personal development, through studying people like Jim Rohn, who have and Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, a couple of life manuals which I sort of read a couple of times a year, which guys has got me, and I suppose educated myself to such a level where I can go out and add value to people. Because the difficulty at the minute is with the likes of, I mean, one of the guys, you've probably heard of a chap called Nick Leeson.
Very much so. Yeah, he was the one who brought down Barings Bank. He was the rogue trader. Yes.
Yeah, so Nick bust the Queen's Bank, $852 million. And Nick worked for us for a couple of years. He's a friend of mine. He lives in Ireland now. And if you look at Nick's story, I mean, this is sort of all each of us. We could learn a lot from his story very, very quickly. 26 years of age, headhunted from the city, took over and run the Queen's Bank, Coutts Bank. And he basically ran that bank for 4 or 5 years very, very successfully. And there was no checks in place. He pretty much did what he wanted. He used to ring London every Friday and say, I need another 50 million, I need another 100 million, I need another 200 million. And nobody thought it important to do their due diligence and check out what he was doing. And what he was doing, he created this 5/8 account, and he was chasing losses that he had lost, right? And that went on for 4 years. And one of the best things I've ever learned in business, and Nick tells the story better than me, is if there's something wrong, if you're not happy, if there's problems in your life, be it business, personal, relationships, health, whatever, the most important thing you can do and the first step is to ask for help. And I've written about this, I've blogged about this, I've spoken about this, and it's three words: ask for help. And that's the start of recovery. And the other thing that Leeson says is education is nothing without understanding. And I think that's a great line for the Brexit story, because education is nothing without understanding. So if you don't understand Brexit and everything about Brexit, why would you put a vote to the British people? If David Cameron didn't understand Brexit and the consequences of an exit, then why did he put it to the British people? Surely beyond anybody that, with half a brain cell would have put it out to consultation, would have ran us through the business model, but he didn't, because he tried to wing it. He thought that Remain would win.
But this also filters down to every single one of us who have, you know, we've voted, or even in your case, you know, plenty of people haven't voted, but whatever it is, it filters down to every individual to be educated about what's happening. And hopefully that's something we can do with this podcast, because Brexit is going to be something we are going to be living for a long time, and it, you know, we're only just even starting to scratch the surface, certainly we think, of what may be coming down the track at us. And the more we can all become educated and talk about it and learn from each other, then the more this starts to become A, more understandable, B, people are more able to take action, but C, very much like you said earlier about the travel angle, it's very easy for people to become blinkered into their own community, their own peer group. You need to get outside of that. You need to see what people are thinking, you know, in other towns, in other cities, in other countries, and hopefully that's something we can provide. Thanks so much for shedding so much light on your part of the world there.
Just briefly, the one thing I would add, and I've had to learn this myself. I have a business partner who has been a big influence on me. He's a lot older than me, been around a bit longer. And I meet businesses and entrepreneurs every day. And no matter who you meet, you know, there's always guys who are great at selling wine, or they build a great house, or they've got a great product or whatever. Most people can be an expert at something. But there's one common denominator that I think people need to sort out very, very quick if we're to keep repeating the mistakes of the past. And it's this: there's an unbelievable lack of understanding around money and finance out there. There really is. You know, I'm seeing it every day, and that's causing people to make the same mistakes, businesses to go bust. You know, we don't teach it in our schools. I think there's a problem with our curriculum. We're not taught to be entrepreneurs. There's a friend of mine who has got a program in Australia at the minute that's called Kidpreneur, where they teach children from 5 years of age in market stalls to trade and sell. And I think the whole curriculum here needs to change, and we need to try and teach our young people to become entrepreneurs and business people, because we don't get that through our academic career. We fall into it.
You're absolutely right. It's not taught academically. I mean, as you know, we, along with my wife and another partner, we started our own company 4 years ago. We've been growing that. We're now open across 25 countries, I think it is now. But there is so much available in this internet age of inspiration for entrepreneurs and motivation. And you can learn about online marketing. You can learn about every facet of business from the internet. It is a phenomenal resource, whether it's podcasts or ebooks or websites, blogs, whatever. There is one area that is not covered, and that's financial education for entrepreneurs. And I think you're exactly right. I couldn't agree more that that is a massive glaring insight, both in curriculum and also just in the entrepreneurial space.
No, it's incredible, and I think the only way that's going to change is that we start educating people around that actual problem, and then working out how do we how do we make it go away or improve it. So,
Conor, just one final question. I'm quite interested to know what's your personal driver and motivation, because you seem a very driven chap.
I get a real buzz from helping people. It's a bit cliche, but we I mean, I was in work this morning at 7:30. Our office was flat out all day. We're launching this new business tomorrow, and it's just a real buzz for me that we can, as a small business, we had an idea 5 years ago to help people, and money's not my driver. I didn't come from big money. I have enough money to do me, and it doesn't bother me, and it's easy to say that, like, whenever you have enough money to survive, because there's a lot of people who don't have enough money. But I think, you know, my goals at the minute, business goals, are to continue developing the small business that we have and add value to the local business community. And then the plan for me is to exit and go into a different space completely in 3 years' time, which is probably going to be around, you know, adventure sports, endurance, well-being, brain health, mental health, and trying to help people get on the right path in life, which will ultimately result in them being able to become better versions of themselves.
And that's it for today. I really hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please do feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Pohl, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin McLeod.